After 6 months investigating how Jan Korbat deceived his patients into carrying his children, I feel like I've found some answers. From listening to the mothers who gave birth to his babies.
I feel my ugly.
He abused you.
I feel my dirty.
You felt dirty?
Yes. Because I was in the room, and maybe in the next room, he make sperm. And then he come to me.
And the children he created.
I'm not a product out of love. I feel like a mass production, really. And if you think about it, that you are with now 75 different people. You have the same DNA. You feel like you're like a robot or something.
I've got a sense of how Korbat's actions have affected hundreds of people who will live with his legacy for the rest of their lives. And I've managed to build up a picture of what sort of doctor is prepared to abuse his patient's trust in such an appalling way.
He was a guy who didn't like rules, who wanted to be as effective as possible.
You have a business reason, which is that it's sort of easier, people are lazy or donors don't show up.
I think he has a God complex.
I think he ignored any potential harm.
Or you have power, the desire to insert oneself into a person's life in completely unorthodox ways.
In this, the last episode of the series, I'm going to find out what the future holds for the people created through Jan Korbat's deception. Those who have found friends for life.
It's funny to find your sister after 35 years.
Yeah. A positive thing, clearly.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Those who will suffer for life.
Every single day, everything that I do, I'm reminded of what Korbat has neglected to do, basically.
And those for whom life is still on hold.
Do you think Korbat might be your father?
Potentially, yes.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and from Something Else, this is The Immaculate Deception. Episode 7, The Car Bastards.
Lots of bikes.
Lots of bikes.
It's Friday night, and I'm walking through the centre of Rotterdam trying not to get run over by all these people on bicycles. And I'm on my way to a get-together. I'm here to meet two half-siblings, Korbat's daughters, who didn't know they were related a few years ago, but now they've found each other, they're pretty good friends. They meet up every couple of weeks, and they've told me that tonight I can come and join them.
Marsha Elvers and Inge Hellar had invited Paul and me to dinner.
Hello.
We've heard from Marsha throughout the series, and also from Inge, too. Her legal father is the former undertaker who helped bury Korbat. Inge suggested we meet at her office. She'd ordered in some sushi.
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness.
So, no, don't stop eating for me. Let's start.
It's very warm, so...
Okay, well, should I do this with my hands?
Yeah.
Marsha grew up thinking she was an only child, but being a child of Korbat means getting new siblings every few weeks.
I was at work, and one time I was in a meeting, and I opened my email, and I said, oh, wow, look at this. I have 8 new brothers and sisters. And then, well, what's the next point on the agenda? And then everybody looked at me, what? it just gets that normal to get those emails and those messages that there are another couple.
Inge told me they were part of an ever-expanding WhatsApp group.
I don't think we're allowed to say the name of the WhatsApp group.
Go on, tell me what the group's called.
The Car Bastards.
The Car Bastards.
Inge's parents told her she was donor-conceived when she was 25. 10 years later, when she became a parent herself, she wanted to investigate her genetic heritage. She took a commercial DNA test, which led her first to Joey and then to Marsha. In 2017.
You met while having a DNA test?
Yeah.
That's the thing you do if you don't hurt child. You want to meet up and do a test? Yeah, sure. Let's have dinner also.
But even before they saw the results of the test, they were pretty sure they were siblings.
Because we went to dinner together, and then we just sat across each other and looked at each other. Oh, wow, you look the same in that. Oh, you do that? You handle your... how do you call
it? Knife and fork.
Yeah, your knife and fork in the same way. And, oh, you like spicy food too, yeah.
It's so really funny, like you're looking in a mirror.
And do you have things in common personality-wise as well?
No.
There's so much that they share. Most obviously a mischievous sense of humour, which means they can find comedy even in the incredibly dark circumstances in which they found each other. And they share a family. Their children, who are cousins, love each other.
My eldest and your youngest, they're very similar too, in the way they move, in the way they act. And
also, it's so funny when they walk. Yeah. They have those bumps.
Yeah.
They wiggle in the same way. Yeah.
There is a Corbett look, isn't there?
Oh, yes. I think, especially the eyes, the pinching down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the kind of smiley eyes.
Smiley eyes. And the higher cheekbones. Yeah. That's really a sign.
Oh, the big mouth with a lot of teeth.
Yeah. And the square hands.
Yeah, square hands. Yeah, it's really too bad.
Gosh, you have really distinctive hands, don't you?
Yeah. We don't like it.
You don't like it?
No.
Small, square.
Yeah. Look at that.
It was uncanny to see the doctor's hands in these two women. Corbett might be dead, but he lives on through them and all their siblings.
How does knowing the truth about your genetic origins, how does that affect the sense of who you are?
That's really a hard question because you have the nature-nurture discussion, and I used to think that there would be a lot of nurture, but now I've come to see there is a whole lot of nature involved, and even more than I used to think, or maybe than I want to believe. Yeah.
Do you worry that you might have inherited negative traits from your biological father? Because he was, to have done this for so long on such a scale, he has to have been quite manipulative. He has to have been a huge combination of a lot of factors and have a kind of ability to suspend his empathy, maybe.
Absolutely. DNA. The first thing you think. And I have colleagues and I ask her, if anything happens like he did, please tell me.
So you're paranoid that you might...
Absolutely paranoid. Yeah, that I'm narcissistic and that I'm so egoistic and not considering the feelings of somebody else, of other people.
Psychopathic.
Yeah, maybe that. Maybe that's the harm. That I'm always thinking, okay, am I a psychopath or not?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
But especially that you're thinking about that, it means that you're nothing like it.
Yes,
because
that's
you're
proof
always,
in itself, isn't
yeah,
it?
True, yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed that you don't call him my father, you call him the doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he is the doctor, he donated, that's it. And he hasn't anything to do with my life. That he passed away, I'm totally fine by it, because I don't have to meet him.
It worked out for Inga and Marcia. Corbett has given them a newfound family. While they may worry about his legacy, it's only a few nagging doubts that actually prove they're nothing like their biological father. That's not the case for Natalie de Jong.
You've got this video.
Yeah.
Can we see it?
Yeah, you can see and listen to it. I cannot have it compromised because of the court case.
But you can tell me what's in it.
Yeah,
and
I can tell you.
You can tell me broadly what he's saying.
Yeah. So I will give you
a
pair of
headphones on here.
Natalie exists because of Jan Corbett. He's not her biological father, but he was her mother's fertility doctor. And she says the decisions he made when treating her mother have left Natalie with lifelong disabilities. In 2014, 3 years before Corbett's death, Natalie travelled to Barendrecht to challenge the doctor. She showed me the video she secretly recorded of their encounter on the condition that we don't play the audio here, but we can describe it.
Let's see where it is.
Yeah, this is it.
Clearly.
Okay, so you're walking up to the Bydorp clinic. Yeah. There's that.
That's the
Disney
house
building with the stork on the top.
The stork, you see it very well here. First, his wife comes out, Rita. And she looks at us and she's like, oh, are you coming here for the apartments? No, we're actually here for your husband. Oh, well, he never tells me anything anyway, so it's fine. Now we're waiting for Karbat. I hear him whistling on the background. It's Karbat
there
himself.
There he is. He's in a stripy shirt. Oh, yeah, it's definitely him. Eyes that I recognize in so many people I've interviewed. So what's he saying here?
He's like, so you wanted to talk to me? I was like, yeah, it's for me. I am donor conceived. My parents had your help. And I had some questions about that time.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
I am currently 39 years old. I'm going to be 40 in a couple of days, actually.
Oh, happy birthday for
Thank you.
I went to see Natalie in Roosendaal, near the Belgian border, in the home she shares with her cats.
There are seven Sneaky Gollum Gypsy. Seven is black and white, and Sneaky is blue with white. She got her name because she just popped up and I just yelled out, she is so sneaky.
Natalie trained as a nurse, but she can't work these days.
So I do a lot with hobbies. I don't work because of my my disease. Mm. Fitness, that's what I do a lot. I make prints for t-shirts, but also stickers like to put on doors, walls, cars.
Did you do the stickers that are on these walls?
Yeah, I did.
I was admiring them.
Yeah.
Faith, hope, love. And there's one in the toilet that says, family is a word that begins with love.
Yeah. When I look at my extended family, everything began with love.
Natalie found out that she was the child of an anonymous donor when she was 17, when her parents were splitting up.
All of a sudden, my mom said, your dad is not your dad. And I was like, what are you saying? This is crazy. Of course my dad is my dad. She wanted to tell me from the moment that I turned 13, actually.
But she'd been compelled to keep quiet.
Karbat told them there's a secrecy contract that you both have to sign. None of my parents could ever tell the children.
A condition of having the treatment was they had to promise to never tell you where you came from.
Exactly. If they wouldn't sign the contract, then they wouldn't have gotten the treatments.
Her home is full of medical equipment, nebulizers she uses to inhale medicine, Zimmer frames to help her walk. As she sat on the sofa opposite me, her fingers curled inwards on her lap, uncomfortably.
One of the things that I have is rheumatoid arthritis. My immune system eats basically my bones away. And that caused me to have now two new knees. I have two new hips. I have two new shoulders. I have two plates in my wrists with about 16 screws on each side. So I cannot move my wrists anymore.
She has another autoimmune disease too, Sjogren's syndrome, which has uniquely devastating symptoms.
I have Sjögren's syndrome. I cannot cry anymore, so I don't have any tears left. That's what I would joke about. If people can't see me crying, it's like, yeah, sorry, my tears are all done. I don't have any more. I don't have much saliva in my mouth. I always have a very, very, very dry mouth.
Do you miss being able to cry?
Very much so, yeah. Sometimes crying can be such a relief. And not being able to do that, even with all the pain that has been caused about the being donor conceived, it's hard not to be able to cry.
When did you begin to think that there might be a link between your conditions that you're living with and the circumstances of your conception?
That was actually already when I was 21 and diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. My doctor immediately started to ask me about my parents and my grandparents. And I had to say, I'm donor conceived, so I don't know.
There was no history of the disease in Natalie's mother's family. Any genetic link had to come from her donor father, but he was anonymous, and there was no way of discovering who he was, so Natalie gave up hope of finding out more about him. Until 2014.
There was an item on the news, and my mom called me because she heard the name Karbat. I was literally in shock.
The scandal of what happened in the clinic was only beginning to emerge then.
All that they knew at that time was that there were mistakes made, a lot of mistakes made.
Natalie wondered, could Karbat's mistakes be responsible for the health problems she faced every day? Her boyfriend decided to help her investigate.
And he went online, he found his phone number, and he called it, and crazily enough, he answered, Karbat himself.
Natalie's boyfriend told Karbat that he was thinking of becoming a donor. He pretended to ask his advice because he used to be such a big name in the fertility industry. Even though Karbat's clinic had been closed for 5 years by then, the doctor told him to come round later that day.
Why do you think he said yes? Because his ego was flattered?
Yeah, definitely his ego was flattered.
Natalie and her boyfriend went to Barendrecht and he started filming on his phone. In the video, the doctor comes out of the yellow building whistling. Natalie is visibly nervous. She tells him he helped her parents conceive her and that she has questions for him.
I asked him about what happened in the news. This is all nonsense. He also lied about using his own sperm. He said, I never did that. I never, ever, ever did that. That's madness. In his words, it's nonsense.
She told him about her inherited diseases. She hoped for some kind of explanation from the man her parents once relied on when they needed help. But he said,
34 years ago, women only wanted a child. No one thought about hereditary diseases.
Back when Natalie's parents had visited Karbat in the 70s, the doctor made a lot of promises about the qualities of their sperm donor.
He would be tall, just like my father. He would be slim, just like my father. He would have dark eyes. That's the features that he would look at.
And did he promise to screen for other things?
Yeah. He would screen all donors for STDs. He would test them if they had like hepatitis, something like that. He would check the blood. He would check blood pressure. My disease, rheumatoid arthritis, it was possible to find it in the blood. And then he also told my parents that there would not be more than 6 donor-conceived children from one donor.
But when Natalie told Karbat about her medical problems, he shrugged it off, like a shop assistant refusing to return a faulty item.
I conceived 10,000 children. Everyone has been checked. 0.2% had hereditary diseases. So I'm so sorry, there's nothing I can do about it anymore.
Natalie asked Karbat if she could access her paperwork to find out more about her donor. He said no.
The practice is completely empty. It's now living arrangements for people. So sorry. Nothing to be done about it.
Do you think he saw you as a creation of his?
Yeah. When the conversation ended, we were walking off. I remember feeling very queasy, very sick, actually, physically sick. And then he asked me, all of a sudden he turned back to me and he asked me, do you have children of your own? And I looked at him and said, no, no, not yet. And he was like, oh, that's a shame.
So he wanted to know if his work was going to continue through you having children.
That's what he wanted to know.
Since that encounter with Carbat, Natalie has managed to piece together some key elements of her genetic history. DNA tests have revealed she already has 60 half-siblings. And through them, she's discovered the identity of her donor father. He worked for Carbat as a nurse, and he's passed away. She told me he was supposed to have been a very good man. It's brought her some comfort. But there's no respite from the pain of the hereditary diseases. The rheumatoid arthritis that means her body is filled with metal. The Sjogren's syndrome that's robbed her of her tears. Natalie says many of her half-siblings have similar conditions too. So many people have been hurt by Jan Carbat's arrogance. His contempt for his patients and their children, his carelessness, has harmed generations of people, even the ones he didn't father himself. Natalie is one of the 53 people suing Carbat's estate for damages.
When I confronted him, he said that he never screened donors at all. If they were healthy, they were healthy, that was it. He didn't care.
And you're living with the consequences of this every day.
Yeah, every single day, everything that I do, I'm reminded of what Carbat has neglected to do, basically.
What does justice look like for you?
For me, justice looks like Rita Carbat saying, yeah, he did things wrong.
Rita Carbat's name has come up a lot in the interviews that we've done. People have strong feelings about her. Is there anything that she could have done differently that might have meant that you wouldn't be pursuing the case as far as you have done?
I think if she would have acknowledged that he did father the children, the donor children that were conceived by him and that were made by him, if she would take any responsibility and just acknowledge what went wrong, but also just a simple sorry, this shouldn't have happened. Yes, it did happen. It shouldn't have happened. And I am sorry for you guys. That would be step one.
There's step two as well, though, isn't there? Because you want financial compensation.
Yeah. Step two would be financial compensation. But for me, it's not the most important thing. I have a happy life. I live a happy life. Yes, it's not what I wanted it to be. And yeah, money, it's great. It will make my life easier. But it would not bring me back my health. My iron bones, it would not make them bones and cartilage again. It doesn't undo the scars that I have on my body and the mental scars that I have inside. It doesn't undo that. It just makes life a lot more easier.
Are you arguing that you shouldn't have been conceived?
No. I do feel if, you know, I didn't have a say in it. Yeah. That's true. I didn't have a say in being conceived and the way that I was conceived. But I do know that I was born from a big fiery desire from my parents to have me. I shouldn't have been born this way. But should I have been born? Yeah, because my parents really wanted me. I don't blame my parents at all.
You blame Carbat for having not delivered to your parents what he promised to deliver.
Exactly. That is the essence of it all for me.
So what are you in all of this? You're a defective product.
Basically, yeah, I'm a defective product. And sometimes I have to be tuned up. You know, I have a lot of siblings calling me the Transformer. Transformer sister, or Terminator is also a term that I've heard. Bionic woman, the bionic sister.
As Rita Carbat's lawyer told me, she doesn't want to respond to any of the allegations against her or her husband, to me or anybody else. Natalie doesn't know if the case against Carbat's estate will be successful. She's got strong grounds for a claim, but if she wins, she won't get a life-changing amount of money. That's not how things are done in the Dutch civil courts. Whatever the outcome of the court case, Inge and Marcia aren't part of it.
This legal case is ongoing, and it's my understanding that you haven't joined the quest for compensation. You don't want compensation. Why is that?
That's a nice question.
Okay, yeah. We talked a lot about it.
Yeah.
I don't feel victimized. I don't see the harm for myself. I have a nice life. I have beautiful children. He's given me life in that kind of way, and I enjoy it. I don't think we have the right to prosecute against the family of Carbat, of his legal children, because they are victims in this case too. They couldn't help the acts of their father.
So it was victory enough for you to have it officially established that he was your father,
yeah,
and then your aunt.
That's so. When you are in Holland, it's not really common to ask for compensation. Mm. So I don't think that the amount of money will not be that high, not as in the States or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
So we were talking about, okay, then we have 2,000 euros and then we buy a couch from Jan.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to sit on that couch.
So
what do you do with that money?
It's true. What do you do with it?
Yeah.
Do you know, I really was not expecting when I sat down for this interview that it would be going like this.
Yeah.
Of course, Marcia and Inge can laugh about it all, but they're a minority. And the number of Carbat kids keeps growing.
Realistically, you might have, you know, this 50-whatever siblings could be the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. But I think we crossed a line already somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's 18 or 58 or 100 or 200, it's crazy anyway. So it doesn't really matter so much anymore. Yeah. And it actually makes me feel sad a little bit about the people who are joining the group now, because it's so hard to give everybody the attention that they deserve. If somebody is number 59 and enters the group, and it's really hard to find the energy to tell that and to
take the same level of interest.
Yeah, yeah, for the 59th time.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're new and if you don't know anything about the story and everything, and then you come into those enormous parties.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah,
it must
be. So overwhelming. So that's concerns me a bit. Yeah.
Their half-brother, Joey, told me the same thing when I met him.
At the beginning, it was really happy and safe. But when the group became bigger, you feel like a pressure. Mm. And it's almost abstract at the time, because you have now 75 different people, all with their own unique story and their different view on lives. And if I give Marcia attention, yeah, there's a whole group of people that also deserves the attention,
yeah,
that I cannot give.
You can't have the energy to have
no
proper brother relationships
with so many people. Yeah, and that's the hardest thing at this time to process, because you really want to, but you can't, because we are with so many.
Mm.
And I'm really emotional about it. That's the hardest thing for me right now. I want to give them all my attention and I can't.
You're really emotional about it, aren't you? Yeah.
Joey's part of the legal action because he says his entire life has been overshadowed by the doctor's deception. Marcia and Inge know how lucky they are. to feel differently.
Do you imagine that some people are really finding it very hard to deal with?
Of course. I can totally engage with people who have really hard time hearing about Karpat is your father. If you're already depressed or there's something in your life and then you hear about Karpat, then I strongly believe it's doing somebody really harm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
While the donor-conceived people I've spoken to for this podcast have different views about the harm Karpat may have caused them, they all agree on one thing. They wish they'd been told the truth about how they were conceived a lot earlier.
In the beginning, I really wanted to tell my story to reach other donor children and also their parents, to just let them know it's okay to tell your child. It's necessary to tell your child that you're a donor child, and don't keep it a secret. Tell your children, because I also see the effect on our brothers and sisters who find out that they are donor children when their parents are already deceased and there is no information to get anymore. You can't ask your mother why didn't you tell me or what happened.
Is there anything that we can learn from all of this?
Definitely, for the parents of any donor-conceived individual anywhere in the world has to know that secrets have a way to come out. And it's better to hear it from your parents, from your own parents, if you are donor-conceived, because it will come out.
There are probably people listening to this right now who have no idea they could be part of this story or one of the many other stories like this, simply because of the secrecy that surrounds donor conception. The stigma of infertility, particularly male infertility, and the secrecy and shame that surrounds fertility treatment because of it, gave Karpat the power that he abused so completely. He knew that his patients wouldn't question him and wouldn't tell anyone about the treatment he was giving them, not even the children conceived as a result of it. He was able to cause so much harm because he worked with incredibly vulnerable patients who promised to keep secrets in an age where doctor always knew best. It was the perfect storm. Maybe Jan Karpat was the product of another era. Perhaps doctors aren't put on pedestals so much anymore. But they still have a lot of power. Infertility is still stigmatized, and fertility treatment is still an intensely private, personal experience for anyone who goes through it. People are still keeping secrets. One thing has certainly changed, though. Sperm donors can no longer expect to be anonymous anymore. Across the world, donor-conceived people are winning the right to know where they come from. DNA testing means that people are able to investigate their identity in ways never conceived of before. The truth is coming out. We'll be better equipped to face it if we're more open about fertility problems in the first place. The story of Jan Karpat will never be over. He has touched too many lives, too many generations. And some people are only just discovering that they're part of it.
Well, we are in Scheveningen, very close to the sea. And that's what
this is Anne. She's asked us not to use her last name. She lives in a bright apartment overlooking the North Sea near The Hague. When I met her there, she was in the middle of doing some decorating. The living room had that new paint smell.
This morning we finished that wall. It's very fresh, yes.
It was in 2017, not long after she graduated from university, that Anne's mother told her the news.
So she told me that she doesn't know who my father is, but it's not for sure that it's not my dad.
Anne's parents went to Karpat for fertility treatment because her father had a low sperm count. but they conceived Anne's little sister naturally, without help.
So they don't know if my conceiving was from sperm of my dad or sperm of the insemination by the Corbett Clinic.
Last spring, Anne took a DNA test to compare with her legal father. She discovered he's not her biological father. It vindicated something inside her. She'd grown up feeling awkward and out of place. And now she finally understood why.
Everyone has told me a lie during my whole life. Mm. And I needed to believe that lie to maintain and to keep going instead of trusting myself. You have learned me to trust someone else's opinion instead of myself. Mm.
To doubt yourself.
To doubt myself. But also the feeling that I have inside couldn't be real because everyone around me is telling me differently.
A few months ago, Anne submitted her DNA to the Dutch FIOM database. Anytime now, she's going to find out whether she's the latest member of the Corbett family.
I have one sister and I'm very happy with her. And I can't really imagine my life with like more than one. So it would be a very weird experience to in one moment get so many other brothers and sisters.
Potentially you could have more than 50.
We could go 100.
Do you think Corbett might be your father?
Potentially, yes. I think every man that ever donated is a potential dad to me.
Have you looked at pictures of him and looked for similarities?
You look for similarities in everyone around you now. It's not that I didn't, but I think you can find anything of yourself in anyone if you try your best. And I try not to do that because that will mean I can't walk down the street anymore. I think there is absolutely a chance of him being my dad.
So any moment from now on, you could find out that you're part of the Netherlands' biggest family.
Yeah.
Will you make contact with your half siblings, or will you wait a while? Or
probably yes. I think curiosity will win.
Will you tell us when you get the news?
Yes. If you want to.
Oh, I want to hear the news.
Yes, I will.
We'll keep you posted. The Immaculate Deception is a Something Else production. It was written and presented by me, Jenny Kleeman. Paul Smith is a producer, with additional production from Arlie Adlington. Mixing and sound design comes from Will Short at Spoke Media. The editor and executive producer is Peggy Sutton. Thank you to Magda Saron, Dan Cocker, Mark Rivers and Steve Ackerman. If you identify with any of the issues we're reporting on and have a story you'd like to share with us, our email address is deception@somethingelse.com.